Follows me, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's nice. Okay.
Can everybody hear?
Yeah, so for everybody in the virtual realm, can you hear us?
Yep, you're good.
Is that Bill?
Nope, it was Dave Davis.
Oh, there's Dave right there. Okay. Dave,
look,
looks like maybe Bill showed up, but he's very small on the screen. I can't really make out that it's Bill. No, you're fine. I don't need to see all that. Okay. All right, well, it's good to see you. Dave, you should have come in. We've been giving you a sandwich, man.
I know, and I'm not a guy that likes to pass up a free lunch, but nonetheless, schedules were such, and I'm going to be really, I think, relatively short on this meeting. I've got another thing I got to get
well,
to, but thanks.
Informed or not, though, what we'll do is let's call the meeting to order, right, and then welcome to the Employer Advisory Full Council. Let's get into stuff. For the Unemployment Insurance Division for the state of Utah. And then knowing that Dave's got some time constraints, why don't we just jump right into our opening business, which would be let's go over the approval of the minutes. Has everyone had a chance to take a look at the minutes before today's meeting? Okay. So I need a motion to.
Motion to approve.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That's six, right? Okay. Well then, any opposed to the motion? All right. Well then, we will accept the minutes from the last meeting. Today, you guys know we're a little early because we've now switched to the two meetings a year schedule. But I thought, or we actually have to have annually our open and public meetings act training. And Robert Andresen has volunteered. He was excited to do so, I imagine.
That's my favorite
thing. And I know it's our favorite training to give or to receive. So I will hand it over to Robert and then we'll be right here for you.
I'm going to sit down and that's if there's some left in the white. It's nice that we're having this training right after lunch. If you need a nap. Justin turned the heat off so you wouldn't fall asleep. But
hey, don't give up the secrets.
All right. All right, what am I doing?
Oh, is it not
on?
It might not be on.
I can turn it on.
Why are they shooting back here? I don't know. Is it not for me?
Oh, there are those
They might, this might be out of range. Sorry.
Okay.
This will be the next slide. Don't worry. UL does this all the time, so they don't know how to run clickers either.
Yeah. So this is opening public meetings training. We can go to the next slide. So the purpose of this requirement, the reason we have the Open Public Meetings Act is to ensure that public bodies are taking their actions openly and conducting the business of the public open so the public can see it. A public body is one that is created by statute or rule, has two or more members, expends public revenue, or is supported by public revenue and makes decisions regarding the public's business. So the act applies only to those public bodies. Of course, the EAC is created by statute under the Employment Security Act, has at least 10 members, is supported by public revenues, and advises DWS and the legislature on policies and problems related to the Employment Security Act. So it qualifies as a public body. To participate in a public meeting it means that each of the members has the ability to communicate with each other, so either in person or online. Thank you. So what is a public meeting? What do we talk about when we say meeting? The definition has changed recently, but essentially it's the gathering of the public body to discuss matters that it has jurisdiction over. It needs to be called by an authorized person, as Justin did today. A quorum must be present, which is a simple majority. Typically, sometimes the statutes will require more or less people, but in general, it's a simple majority. The statute doesn't define this any longer. It used to say that a public meeting does not include chants or social gatherings. It doesn't have that language anymore, but that definition is still applicable. If you happen to run into each other somewhere, it doesn't qualify as a public body. If you gather together for a Christmas party, say in a few weeks, or a holiday party, excuse me, that doesn't qualify as a public meeting. It's when the members get together to discuss a matter that is relevant to their jurisdiction. But do, even though simple meetings or gatherings don't qualify as a public meeting, just remember that sending electronic messages back and forth or trying to make decisions before a meeting occurs or before it's deliberated in a meeting is prohibited. Without a quorum, you can't have a meeting, no official discussion of matters can take place. We can go to the next. So the default rule, if you don't take anything else away from this other than remember that a public, a meeting of a public body needs to be open to the public. Oh, thanks. There are some circumstances when meetings can be closed. We'll talk about those in a minute. And as I mentioned, the members of a public body can't get together beforehand to make decisions of something that should be decided in a public meeting. You don't want to predetermine an action that needs to be discussed in front of the public and use a public comment and decided and voted upon in a public meeting. So, there's kind of two basic requirements for public meetings. It's similar to in the legal world, due process. You want to give everyone notice of the meeting and a chance to be heard. Those are the same requirements of a due process. Notice of a public meeting, the bare minimum is 24 hours under the statute. Obviously, if you can provide more notice than a longer advance notice than that would be ideal, just as a matter of customer support and fostering the relations with the members of the public that you interact with. But 24 hours is the minimum. We have now what is called a Class A notice, which we're required to provide at a public meeting, and essentially that gives the public information about the date, time, and place of the meeting and the agenda, what's going to be discussed at the meeting. And then if your public body holds regular meetings during the year, it sounds like you have them twice every year, at least once a year you need to post notice of that regular schedule when those meetings will occur. For the notice requirement, a Class A notice, you can fulfill that requirement by, it needs to be posted on the state public, notice website, and then also on the, public body's website. So, we have those examples here on top of the state website that all public bodies can post notices to, and then you know, the particular employment advisory council, which I has the meetings noticed there as well. You may recall that there used to be a requirement to physically post a notice, like on the building or somewhere. That requirement still exists, but it's more limited. It's been limited this past year. So if your jurisdiction, as this body covers the entire state, then that physical posting requirement is no longer required. If you have a smaller, say, a city or something like that, you may need to post it within the city limits. But where we cover the entire state, the actual physical posting of a piece of paper isn't required. With respect to the agenda, the same thing, at least 24 hours notice. Again, if the agenda, you know, may be developed a little bit later than the actual schedule, you'll know the date, time, and place fairly early on for your meeting. If your agenda takes a little bit longer to develop, it still needs to be posted at least 24 hours early. Again, I would recommend earlier than that if you can. The topics on the agenda need to be identified with reasonable specificity. So, you know, as much detail as you can give so that people understand what's going to be discussed. Only the items that are listed on the agenda may be voted upon or final action may be taken upon during the public meeting. If it's not on the agenda, it can be discussed. So if a member of the public comes into the meeting and raises a topic that's not on the agenda, it can be discussed. You don't have to, but you cannot take a vote or final action on that item if it wasn't listed in the agenda. And if you posted an agenda and it has any errors, you can correct that if you don't have time to still give adequate notice, then again, you can discuss the matter, but can't take any final action on it. So, the recommendation would be to hold off on doing anything with something that wasn't listed on the agenda and just, if you can, handle it at the next meeting. Occasionally, you may need to schedule an emergency meeting. I can't imagine that comes up much in this group, but, if there is an urgent or emergency matter, you can schedule an emergency meeting to discuss it. You still need to give the notice, as we've discussed, and it needs to be given the best notice practical is what the statute requires. So basically that means attempting to notify all members of the public body. A majority of the members must approve of the emergency meeting. And then still have the same notice and agenda requirements, just as best you can. If you do hold an emergency meeting, the minutes should reflect that majority of the members have voted and approved holding the meeting. And this is not in the statute, but it is kind of a best practice. If you hold an emergency meeting, you should probably only discuss whatever topic prompted the emergency meeting. You don't want to schedule an emergency meeting, discuss that, and then also move on to other unrelated business. So best practice would be just focus on what the emergency is, take care of it, and then do the other business at a regularly scheduled meeting. So closed meetings. Meetings can be closed occasionally for to conduct certain business, discussing, you know, an individual's competence, litigation, purchases, or procurement. There's to be the key aspects of the negotiation private, evaluating bids, protecting trade secrets, those items. Two-thirds of the members of the public body need to vote to close the meeting. And then once the meeting is closed, you cannot take a vote on any items other than to end the closed portion of the meeting. So you can go into the closed session, discuss and then take a vote to close it and go back to the public meeting and make a decision and vote on the item, keeping, you know, those items private as necessary. So during the meeting, they need to be recorded and it needs to be a complete and unedited record of what happened during the meeting. The recording needs to be posted within 3 business days on the website. If you close a portion of the meeting, it still needs to be recorded. The minutes need to be taken of that portion, but those are protected and not subject to public disclosure. Similarly, for the meeting minutes, those are required for each meeting. It needs to record the date, time, and place of the meeting, who was present, any action taken or votes taken. Needs to include the names of anyone who provided comments and a brief summary of what was discussed and what people said. You can include links to the recording of the meeting, and then as you just did before this, you can need to approve those minutes at the next meeting. So those, at the end of a meeting, you prepare pending, it's called pending minutes. Those need to be posted or made available to the public within 30 days after the public meeting. And then once at the next meeting, once the minutes are approved, those approved minutes need to be made available within 3 business days after approving. And you're all familiar with this as well. Electronic meetings, we're able to conduct meetings either fully electronically or kind of combined in person and electronic. To do so, the public body needs to adopt a resolution or rule authorizing an electronic meeting. It still needs to provide an anchor location such as this, a physical location where members of the public can come to participate in the meeting. The anchor location can be, there are exceptions. If, for example, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, we had the pandemic, if there's a risk to health or safety, then you can hold it completely electronically and not provide the anchor location. But generally, there will still be a physical location that members of the public can come and participate. So why do we have this requirement to have training? You know, we're essentially having a meeting about meetings. What is the purpose? If we don't follow the act properly, then there's a number of consequences that could flow from that. Any action taken by the public body could be voided. Members of the public are entitled to file lawsuits to compel compliance. If you improperly close a portion of the meeting, that can be opened and those records could be open to public inspection. And in any court cases, you know, the public body could be subject to paying attorney's fees and, individuals could also be subject to criminal liability for improperly or for violating the requirements of the Public Meetings Act. And aside from all that, maybe more importantly, is that we want the public to have confidence and trust in what we're doing. And if they perceive that a violation is occurring or they feel like you're trying to hide something, that erodes that confidence. So that's the purpose, and that's why we have these discussions, so that we can help the public feel that they're being heard and that they have a voice in the matters that affect them. So conducting the meeting, just a few ideas. It's, I imagine it doesn't get too controversial here and too raucous, but essentially, you don't want to give anyone the feeling that something's wrong or being hidden. Stay focused on the agenda. You know, make sure things are civil. Definitely allow comments, even if you disagree with them. You know, the public has a right to to disagree and explain their position. But follow procedure, track the motions and votes, and essentially just be the grown up in the room. You don't have to tolerate disruptive behavior. People can be removed, but it needs to be a place where people can feel comfortable expressing their opinions, even if there's disagreement, and we can do that civilly, and it's still at the end of the day, we're respectful to each other. So, with that, if you have any questions, I appreciate your time. And that's, you've been trained. So.
Thank you, Robert. That's the most anticipated training we have all year, Robert. So we'll see you back next year, too. Yeah. All right. Next on the agenda, sticking to the agenda, like Rob said, we have Mike, and I'm sure this is where everyone's really excited for this particular agenda item. It's the rate notices have come out. So Mike has volunteered to offer up some insight on that.
Good afternoon. The only thing better than Open Meeting Training Act by an attorney is tax rate discussion by the tax chief. So. We wanted just to point out a couple of things. How this works is that the federal government all year is tracking information from our workforce development team. Bureau of Labor Statistics is the department. They collate all kinds of data and facts for us. One of the things that two things actually that we received from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, and then is calculated by our own statisticians, is the fiscal year total insured wages. In other words, that's a measure of the trust fund liability. So remember, unemployment insurance is an insurance program run on insurance principles. So if Jeff trades in his 1987 Ford Escort that he's been driving since high school.
He would never trade it.
bad example. But if he were to trade in an older car for a brand new, expensive, top performance, high-end car, obviously his insurance rate's going to go up. So this first measure, the fiscal year, the total insured wages, is simply a measure of the trust fund liability. As we have more workers earning more wages, the trust fund has to be able to cover those wages, just like your insurance has to be able to cover a Mercedes compared to a Ford Escort. Okay, so that's one of the factors we look at. And then the taxable wage base. Simply put, this is the per employee taxation limit that employers need to focus on. I'll talk about that in just a minute, a little bit more about that. So last year, the total insured wages was $102 billion. This year, it's $108. Now we're looking at calendar year here, right? And with tax rates, the best we can do is we can look at the past to project for the future. And that's what we're doing. We're looking at the past. We're getting some information. And we're saying based on the trust fund formula, we're going to project what we need to collect in the future through our tax rates. So we had an increase of $5 billion in total insured wages. So if you've heard the governor's economist say the economy in Utah is strong, I would imagine this would be an indicator that they could point to say the economy is strong. But because the total insured wages increased, so did our liability. Okay. This is the dum-dum-dum serious part of the presentation when we start thinking, oh boy, liability went up, that means tax rates are going to go up. So here's the wage base. Eileen has been asking about this. So the wage base that we use for this year's calculations, it was 47,000. The wage base that we're using or have already used for 2025 is $48,900, so an increase of $1,900. Okay. Eileen's particularly interested in that because she has a guessing game among staff who can guess the new wage base. So there it is, Eileen, $48,900. And what did you say it was when you started?
$17,000.
$17,000.
And that was in 92.
And then just to point out, Justin has talked about this quite a bit in the past. Some states have a low wage base and high taxes. Utah has a fairly high wage base and low taxes. Other states have the feudal wage base, which is $7,000. So when you think of a state as large as California with about 40 million people, Josh?
39 million. Yeah.
39 million people, their wage base is $7,000, meaning the employers in California are paying unemployment taxes on the first $7,000, and then any dollar after that is tax-free. Okay, so that's a missed opportunity to keep a healthy trust fund. Any guesses what the trust fund balance is for California today?
Are they still negative?
No, they're out of the negative. So they got 39 million people.
They still have federal loans, right?
They still have federal loans, as Steve points out. Yep. So in the billions. They're just over half a billion, so $500 million in their trust fund. So that's not good, by the way.
That's insured. $48
million? $39 million.
And what is your time sharing roughly?
Well, Justin gets to share that information.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. It's a cliffhanger.
I don't think that's in my presentation, but it's about $3 million. Three million people, and I think that's the last population run, is generally speaking.
Yeah. So here you go. Here's our new minimum rate for 2025. It actually went down. So 0.002. Last year it was 0.003. I say last year. 2024 is 0.003. The maximum stays the same. That means the liability for employers, the minimum liability that employers, if they qualify for that minimum rate, is only $97 per employee. Last year, 2024, it was $141. So even though our taxable wage base increase, our taxes have gone down. How about employers? So we've seen an increase in 2,454 employers. I'm using some tax terms here of 108,000 active contributory employers. Contributory employers are those that are required by law to contribute to the trust fund through a tax. And that tax is collected every quarter and deposited into the trust fund. Reimbursable employers are those that don't contribute quarterly. They just receive a monthly bill. A good example of a reimbursable employer would be a nonprofit, a church, certain parts of higher education. Government entities are not going to tax themselves to tax themselves again, kind of deal. So those are reimbursables. So anyway, again, this could be seen as an indication of Utah's healthy economy. This is a great chart that we love to share with folks just to put things in perspective. There are a lot of information to soak in. If you look at the top row here, Utah employers with the minimum rate of 0.2%, 79,433, or 78%. That is phenomenal. 78% of active contributory employers in the state of Utah are paying the lowest tax rate. Now, a lot of that is credited to their management, their HR practices, and managing staff turnover and issues like that. If you go to the next group, 0.3 to 0.9, you're up to 88%. And then 95, and we can see how it climbs. Okay. So these are employers that are active. They're registered with unemployment insurance. 78% of them have the lowest possible rate that they could qualify for. Great news for employers. Rate notices. We calculated all the rates this week. Steve, I don't know if you've got any electronic correspondence. So, employers that sign up for electronic correspondence, they get that email telling them to check their inbox or to log in and see their rate. And then this week, Julie, this probably today even, and tomorrow, we have a contract with State Mail to publish all of this information. So they're printing it off, folding it, putting it in an envelope, affixing the postage, and they're sending those out. So about 50,000 or 45% of employers use electronic, which is great, saves us postage. And then the rest are USPS. So here's your quick facts. Again, your wage base is 48,900. the maximum weekly benefit amount that a person that applies for unemployment insurance could receive is up. It's 577. The reserve factor, 1.1. Remember, that's the multiplier.
Michael, right? Can I interrupt? It's 700.
Oh. I was just going to say
that. Yeah, that seems low.
That's my
leave it to the tax guy. That's part wrong.
That's my dyslexia accent.
When we send the notes up, we'll have the script.
What are you saying?
Yeah, it's lucky seven.
It's 777.
Yes.
It's
777.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
I have a quality control that I missed.
I missed that. Sorry, you guys. I think that's it. Everything else we've kind of talked about. Okay. Justin wanted me to just touch briefly on, if you guys remember back to the 2021 session, the legislature actually capped, our formula. And for years, this council has done great trying to help the legislature understand, trust the formula that's in statute. The formula will react, does a historical look back. And based on that look back, it anticipates the future and it's done really well. So this top box, I've got calendar year, what the social cost was capped at, and then what the reserve ratio was capped at for each year. This next box is the actual calculation. You'll notice that the only area where our formula would have been higher was calendar year 2022, the reserve ratio. So the legislature actually capped that. We calculated it should have been 1.2. They capped it at 1.15. Everything else screams trust to the formula, right? So the cap is done. We also had an injection of some money from the federal government, which helped our trust fund out as well. Okay? That's it for me, unless you guys have questions. I know it's scintillating and fascinating and all of those other things. Okay, great. Thank you.
I know I was entertained, Mike.
Yes.
Hey, I wanna point out that's the best report Mike has ever given.
Excellent. Thanks, Dave. How much did he pay you to say that, Dave?
Just a free lunch.
One turkey sandwich is what that cost him.
He's delivering it later today for you.
All right,
thanks, Mike. I know it's like, so let's talk a little bit about the trust fund, and then we'll get to some any questions you guys have. Well, actually, we'll talk about the meeting in a second, too, but... So to kind of go along with what Mike had said, when we look at our, which one's the laser? Is this the top one? When we look at our, this highlighted yellow line is the 2025 tax year. And this is all the data that we used. And not all the data, but it's most of the major points of data that we used to calculate this. So I think when you're looking at it, what we're looking at, the minimum adequate range is 1.3, maximum adequate range 1.8 billion dollars. That's a billion with a B. Our trust fund balance is sitting at $1.2 billion as of June 2024. And I believe my numbers, where did I put them? Over here. Right now it's sitting at $1.286 billion. So, it's right there. Never mind. Should have looked at the screen. So we're sitting a little over $1.25 billion at the moment. Contributions are not looking good. And then if you look at our futures here, I would caution looking at the futures as far as our trust fund goes. Let's come back to this in a second before we get to that, because I want to highlight this. This is our trust fund balance, the minimum and maximum. But let's go to this one first so I can just kind of highlight what's going on right now. So we're looking at 2024. That's this fifth from the right green line with this little dot there. You'll see that taxes collected has taken a bit of a dip in 2024 with our benefits going up in 2024. Now, we've kind of watched this go on in the last year. This isn't anything that we would be normally to it's not out of the ordinary. It's clearly not an abnormal kind of action here. If you go back to the Bush recessions, the Bush recessions, the Great Recession, which then turned into this long, straggled out recovery and growth time period, So I'm not saying that there's going to be a recession or a market correction. What I'm saying is that there, and I think everyone kind of has known this, if you've paid your bills or if you've walked around, you've paid attention to the news, there's a bit of a, what they call kind of a softening or a, you know, a softening or hardening, whatever you want to call it, to the economy. The economy is actually adjusting. And it's not unusual. It is a presidential election year. So that is actually, if you ever look at our election years, you can kind of notice some action, 2008, 2016. You see some things happening in those presidential election years. So a little bit expected. So I'm not really all that alarmed right now. It is to highlight, though, that benefits have gone up. Contributions have gone down. Now, we do, from our state economists, are expecting the economy to get a little bit better. And so when we go backwards, we're looking at the trust fund balance here, but we go all the way back to the future. You're looking at the reserve factor and our social cost. We're expecting them to go down, but now remember, this is something we're looking at 5 years in advance. And if you could tell the future, you'd be rich. No one would be in this room right now because we'd be living on a tropical island at the moment. So don't pay too much attention to the expectations. If everything stays the same, yes, it's going to look good. But does that guarantee everything's going to stay the same? No, no one really knows that. So I don't think I'd want to just say, all right, we're going to be at 0.02 on the social cost and 1.0 for our reserve factor in 2031. That's a long time from now. But it is trending in a positive light. If we stayed in this rate or at this current rate that we're at, we're looking at where we're going to start to get back into the minimum and maximum range here. Which you've kind of noticed they changed some formula throughout time. It was a little more narrowly prescribed, and then we opened it up, which provided a little more consistency to the tax rates. Before that, it was a little bit more hit or miss, and it was a little more wild. And so having a wider minimum and maximum has actually made your taxations, if you kind of notice the trends, just kind of smooth itself out, and that's a good thing. What we have also noticed is that this minimum maximum generally will give us about a 1.5-year AHCM, which is the average high cost multiple. That is to be translated as the amount of time we'd have to pay a maximum amount of benefits if we received no other contributions. We'd have right now it's sitting at 1.2, which means about the 1.25 year we could go. It should be noted that it is if you want it to be around 1.5, or at least in our experience, empirically speaking. Utah likes it to be 1.5 on a good time and a good rate because you're better able to absorb the bad economies, right? The Great Recession almost bankrupted the trust fund, and we were sitting at around a 1.4, I believe, or something like that. I don't know exactly that number, but that's why we want to always strive for this middle ground here. Now, we are having a struggle in the last few years, and I think I talked about this the last meeting, where we are trying to catch up to a moving target. And the moving target is a good thing because that means the economy in Utah is doing great. So there's more wages to insure. And so that's not a bad thing. And so, you know, Jeff's loving it because right now there's construction all over the state and we're loving it right now. And we agree, but this isn't a bad thing. If you've ever watched where we catch up, and I think our friend Bill Starks on the virtual call will kind of attest to this because he was during his experience as well. When the market starts to, or when the economy starts to flatten out, that's when we're able to catch up. Now, why do I point this out? Well, the reason I'm pointing this out is just like Mike touched on. We're trying to always stress that the formula for the trust fund is a naturally reacting formula, and it works well, but it does seem to have some pain points, particularly around the beginning and ending of a market correction. And so it's generally not looked at very positively, at least from our perspective, where we'd say, hey, if you try to artificially cap or influence the trust fund value, you're going to maybe delay things. Now, I'm not going to say that's what occurred here, because like Mike pointed out, the legislature, in their well-meaning ways, tried to cap the process. They didn't really need to, right, because the formula reacted properly, and it actually is catching up. And I'd say their cap wasn't what's causing this. Just the explosive economic growth in Utah is really what's causing this problem. So it's not something that I'd really worry too much right now, and I wouldn't be worried about it in the near future. It looks like we're going to catch up, and we are well positioned to actually react. If we had even a correction that started in the next couple of years, we would be well positioned. Right now, we're sitting at a 1.2 high cost multiple. So it's a good spend. So right now, trust fund is looking good. Is it as good as we'd like it to be? No. Is it terrible? Well, we're not California by any stretch. We have $1.2 billion. California has $500 million. And we only have about 3.5 million people to insure. California has, like, what is that, 13 times the population to insure. So, no, we're in a great spot. And so we continue to be so. And it's led by the efforts of this council. Whenever you guys have been approached to talk about it, we know you guys are saying, hey, look, just leave it alone. These guys do a great job. They're doing fine. And that, we appreciate that. And, you know, in my modest opinion, we do a great job. So I wanted to, before, yeah, that other slide, Julie. Before, and we can get to the questions, but I do have, and I think the last meeting I pulled out and gave you guys a tax benefits at a glance. Go ahead and make that, maybe might want to make it a little smaller so we can see the whole screen. We can. So I've updated it with her most recent information for 2025. You will actually, this will be part of the packet of information that comes out to you. I didn't have time to actually print them all off for you guys today, but we're basically, stupid computer. Every time I try to download it, it always kind of makes the formatting, so I'll try to get that cleaned up. So this is just for you guys on kind of a nutshell. This was our formula. This is all information that's publicly known, so that we're not telling you any insider secrets other than it's just we know where to look for it. This is all the information that was used to calculate the maximum, benefit amount. That's the 777 that Mike didn't pay attention to. Anyway, it's like, our monetary eligibility is 5,300. And so really wanted to highlight the 1.2 years. That's good. We're getting closer once we get to about 1.5. It's actually once we get to around 1.4, 1.3, 1.4. Then you can start seeing the formula starts to slow itself down. That's why we expect the rates to drop. That's why our taxes are expecting to fall in the next few years. Once we get closer to the goal, we're going to kind of slow down so we're not crashing right into that middle ground. But as far as tax payments versus the employees' benefits we're looking at, this is what I actually like to highlight. You guys can, people are sitting there complaining like, oh man, it's so expensive for unemployment. It's $97 a year to insure someone to get potentially $620 on average, which is the average amount of money a person makes in Utah, $65,000. We're rich here in Utah. But the average would be about $620 a week. So per person, every employer is basically paying a $97 a year to have the ability to pay someone $600 to transition. Just $600 a week, maximum of $16,000 to transition to new employment. Remember, unemployment is, the goal of unemployment is not to stay on it forever. The goal is to help them get to the next job. And that's what we ask Leanne, that's her benefits division. I would say harangues the people who are filing for unemployment. They ensure that they're doing it properly to make sure that they're not just loafing around and just taking all the money away because there would be none for the people who really need it. So on that note, this will be available to everybody if you need it. On that note, does anyone have any questions for me or at least with regards to the trust fund? Can applaud, Eileen, if you want to say, wow, you guys are doing such a great job.
Yeah, you know, I would like to see something that would really benefit the employers more.
Well, let's get Sheila's question out of the way before I have to explain your question. If you could, please.
Okay.
Sheila, what do you got?
What does the taxable wage base mean? Is that you only tax up to that?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So the taxable wage in Utah, so there's two different kind of lines of thought for really efficient, well-meaning state. So we don't want to tax someone forever, right? Right. So the people who make a lot of money would say, hey, this is unfair. I make a lot of money and you're taxing me all the way up to, like, let's say $100,000. And so there's only a limit to how much we're going to take from you because we don't need as much money. We don't need as much taxes from an employer. So this is equally attributed to all, workers in the state up to the maximum $48,000. So we will put our tax rate, apply it to every dollar that person makes up to the $48,000. Once they make more than $48,000, we don't tax the employer.
But you'll do less.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. So they're taxed up. That's why we can confidently say, if you are a 2% or a 0.2%, minimum 78% of the employers in the state of Utah, then you're only going to pay $97 per person at most. And that's if they make $48,000. If they make $36,000, it'll be a lot less than that because it's only going to be 0.2% of that that's issued out there. And now some states have, there's two different kind of lines of thought here. Some states have a large tax base. You look at ours and say $48,000, that's a lot. We also have a 0.2% tax rate, which is less than 1%.
The states that have a smaller tax rate, and Steve will nod on this because he deals with other states as well. Some states have a very small taxable wage base, but then to make up for that difference, they have a very high tax rate. So they'll say something like, well, we gotta pay 10% of $9,000 in economy equals up in range. So it's kind of one sixth to one half a dozen to the other. As long as you're handling your program efficiently and you're handling the money properly, most states have either way. Utah just uses a larger tax base with a very small tax rate. Okay, Eileen, did you have, or did you just want to?
Well, did you follow the calculations for the rate? My position is to benefit the employers that have to bid for jobs 2-3 months ahead of time.
Yep.
It would be beneficial for them to know what their rate is earlier than at the very tail end of November. And my position is that needle, to move it, you have to have millions and millions of dollars in there to make that needle move anything. Once they start doing their calculations, because all the data is as of June 30th. Now we're receiving the second quarter information. It's due by the end of July. And so we're processing it, but because most of it's electronically done, it's getting processed a lot faster.
Yep.
So if you were, and they start running the numbers through the calculation formula in August, and they run about every 2 weeks to see what it's going to be. And I'm saying the last month of, say, October, it doesn't move. It really doesn't move. There's some federal guidelines that they send something in, but whatever they send in that goes into the formula still isn't going to move that needle.
I think, you bring up a good point. I think we'd all like to get the rates out as fast as possible. And Mike is constantly wanting to go. We don't want to ruin everyone's Thanksgiving by telling you how much you're going to be taxed next year. That's a terrible letter to get from the government. And it is, I can earnestly tell you, it is the soonest we can get this out. There are some factors in play. Number one, this is a tax rate notice that we want to make sure is 100% accurate. And you're correct. We could probably make some estimates earlier on, but I don't like using estimates because I don't want to tell Jeff, hey, here's your estimate, and then come back later and say, JK, we got to give you another rate. And Jeff wouldn't appreciate that either because it's an unexpected cost. The other piece that we're really running into, and Brad, who can't be here today, reading your sandwich today, Brad, it's delicious. But at the same time, Brad harangues our research analysis division starting in September. He's on it. And I know this because he puts me on the email chains. Mm-hmm. And the big delay that we're running into right now has been the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which we have. And if anyone's dealt with the federal government, you know, they're not the easiest groups to try to deal with. And so we're generally not getting a lot of the information very timely from that element of it. But what we do is when we do get it, we move quick. We basically got this information from our workforce research and analysis last week. And we instantly got to work to get it processed and started. And we actually ran it on Tuesday, mainly so we could make sure the letters were getting out there. I know it's not probably going to answer to your satisfaction, Eileen, but we are going as fast as we humanly possible can go to make sure we're accurate.
You know, what difference does it make if you're off? A slight bit. What I'm trying to tell you though, you go back 10, 20 years and you look at all those calculations that have done, you might find 1 year where that rate changed between mid-October to mid-November. Yes, you have more numbers in there, but it's still not going to change the rate because it's millions and millions of, move that needle.
Yeah, I know. I see what Sam's saying, but I think what they say, civilizations have fallen for smaller amounts than what can happen. And there is a small chance, but that's just a chance I don't want to take. And it's just one that we are conservative on purpose because we want to make sure we get it as accurate, and so we don't have to go back and amend too much information. I get your concern, and we are definitely trying to go as fast as we can. But we want to make sure we do it as accurately as we can. Because if you are right, if we went back to the store and said, yeah, we're pretty much online with everything, it'd be that 1 year where it went south on us. And those usually become epic disasters. And I think we don't want to have that because then I want unemployment. I don't want to do that.
No, you catch it up the next year. It's not like it's going to end. You know, it goes on and on and on. And so any little discrepancy will be included in the next year.
Well, but
calculations.
I don't think that's appreciated by everybody on the council, or at least in the general public as well.
I beg to differ with you. Have you ever had an employer that submitted a bid for a job and he didn't know what his rate was going to be the next year? And this was 2010 when our rates just went sky high.
Yeah.
And that man was in tears on the phone with me, and still bothers me.
But we could have done a projection just for that man had we sent him to employer accounts. We could have done a projection,
but without
calculating the entire state.
I know.
We got the data last Wednesday, and we pushed the button the following Tuesday. We would have done Monday, but we had a health emergency.
Yeah, I think what my point is,
Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, push the button Monday, that's pretty
quick. Right.
I think it's extremely quick, but did it change it?
But I think
that's my point.
Well, here's the thing though, but I think to Mike's point though as well, anybody who wants, if they're worried about their tax liability, a $97 person tax liability, which is one of the smallest in the country, I'm gonna add. If anybody's worried about that, we'll give it an estimate, but it comes with the caveat of saying, hey, this isn't a guarantee. Because officially the guaranteed tax rate goes out when it goes out, and that's when we can stand by it and put a stamp on it.
Because there's a social cost and the reserve factor that can change.
Right. So Dave,
Hey, I just wanted to make a quick comment. Hopefully it'll give Eileen a little bit of peace of mind. The formula is built so that we're not going to get wide swings in the rate. And employers, when they're planning, can always use last year's rate as a plug for their budgets or whatever they're putting together. And then because of how the formula is built, we're not going to see these wide swings. I don't think that most employers, it's not going to be a major problem for them if the rate changes fractionally from what they were planning. So I just don't, I have not heard from any of the employers that I represent that this is a major concern.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. Yeah, and that's kind of the point. And if anyone really has concern, they can ask us early and we can give them an estimate. Yeah. It does come with the caveat of it's not a guarantee, but it makes a great point. All right,
move. Yeah, he did use the last year's rate, and that's why he said he was going to lose on that job.
Well, I mean.
During the era where we had really high rates that hit us in 2010.
And that was an odd time, but we are dealing with 108,000 different employer accounts too. So you can't please everybody, unfortunately. We try to please as many.
Justin, can I just add a positive note to all this?
Yes. Tell Eileen how wrong she is.
I actually still do a little UI consulting, and just so everyone knows, USDOL puts out a lot of statistics on tax rates, and typically one of the measures that they look at so you can compare states is the average tax on total wages, because every state has a different taxable wage base. And if you look at Utah's average tax rate compared to their high weekly benefit amount, they're almost in a category by themselves. We have one of the lowest average tax rates in the nation, yet we're paying higher than the average weekly benefit amounts. You can count on one hand how many states are in that kind of a category. So, kudos to you and your staff. Utah looks really good nationally.
Oh, you can keep talking now, Bill.
We've looked good nationally for decades.
Well, to echo what Bill said, I think we pick on California a lot only because they're a nice example because they're the biggest state in the country. But also, I think their maximum WBA is something like $400. Like, we're almost double.
Yeah.
We're the biggest state in the country.
uses, and we're just little old Utah. And so to Bill's point, we do a good job, and I'm not just bragging because I like to brag.
Oh, I know we do a good job.
But I am bragging because I like to brag too. All right, does anyone else have any other questions? I think, what time is it? I want to make me...
25.
Yeah, we got 5 minutes left on the meeting, so I just want to be, you know, observant of the time and make sure everyone's going to... But yeah, thanks for the point, I think that's noted.
Thank you for listening.
On that note. Okay, real quick, moving on, let's talk about next year's meetings. Now, we're tentatively scheduled for May 15th to November 20th. Cheryl will make sure that everyone gets notified. Do you want to try to bump up our times, maybe to start like at a 12:30 or a 12 to have the munching on the lunch before we have the conversation? What would you guys like to do? Because I think we're pretty open on the times. So we can kind of get whatever we want for time frame. Do you want to maybe start at 12:30 and then go into the meeting efforts at 1? And maybe if Bill ever shows up, he can come and enjoy some in-person sessions with us as well. That goes for you too, Kelly. You're not. I see you over there in the corner of this virtual call too, Kelly.
Dave's still on the call.
Dave is still on the call. Yeah.
Well, can he bring a donut if the tax isn't too high?
Did you hear what Jeff said, Dave?
You're gonna have to eat it with a fork and knife so that it's prepared food.
Okay. All right. Just checking after you guys are busy.
I'll respond right, so, for Dave.
Thanks, Todd. I think, we'll just aim for a 12:30 start, where everyone can grab their lunch. Cause it's not that we're trying to do a freebie to entice you. I mean, the one thing is you guys spend time out of your day to come to this meeting, provide input, listen to the rabid, riveting conversation pieces about the trust fund. The least we can do is at least make it to where it's a little bit bearable. So hopefully we can make it a little bit nicer for you. Especially when it's so cold today. I don't know why it's so cold in South Carolina. Poor Julie's out there. She's chattering. Okay, so we'll switch that up to the 12:30. And then just before we go, I want to open it up to any general questions you guys might have. We technically have members of the public, but they all work for me, so they won't ask any questions right now. Well, they might. If you have any questions, anyone member from the public, I don't think we have anyone from the public online, right? No. Anything right there? Okay, then if you guys want to end it, I need a motion to end. Who wants to get the motion? Steve, you guys a motion to end the meeting? Close the meeting, I should say, actually. And then we need a second.
I'll second it.
Jeff and Bill, second the motion. All in favor, say aye.
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 The opposed? We are closed.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys. Hi, I think that'll give me some burn on this one. Dude, let's go. What are you doing, Eileen? Okay, let me. Okay,
my heart
I love
is
you,
filled with the employers.
I love what Eileen's in now. Sheila, thanks for coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeff, thanks for coming. Steve, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Give my best to all the rest of them back there.